The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Dan Novak reports on the death of former Chinese leader Jiang Zemin. Brian Lin presents this week's technology report. And we close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Jiang Zemin, the former president of China, died Wednesday in Shanghai, Chinese state media report. He was 96. Zhang led China out of the isolation that followed its army's deadly actions against protesters in Tiananmen Square in 1989. As president, Zhang supported economic reforms that led to explosive growth. He served as president for 10 years, leaving office in 2003. He led the ruling Communist Party for 13 years, until 2002. Chinese state media report the cause of death as leukemia, a cancer, and organ failure. His death comes as the country's government faces major public protests of strong COVID-19 restrictions. Over the weekend, demonstrators called for leader Xi Jinping to resign. Zhang was a surprise choice to lead a divided Communist Party after the 1989 unrest. He saw China through history-making changes. Those included free market reforms, the return of Hong Kong from British rule in 1997, and China's admission to the World Trade Organization, or WTO, in 2001. Even as China opened to the outside, Zhang's government did not accept political opposition. It jailed human rights, labor, and pro-democracy activists. His government banned the Falun Gong spiritual movement, which the ruling party saw as a threat to its power. Zhang stopped officially working for the government in 2004, but he remained a force that led to the rise of Qi, who took power in 2012. Qi has crushed the little remains of dissent in China and re-established the power of state industry. The ruling Communist Party declared Zhang a great proletarian revolutionary and long-tested communist fighter in a statement on his death. Reports that Zhang might be in poor health spread after he missed a ruling party meeting in October. At that meeting, Qi awarded himself a third 5-year term as leader. In 13 years as Communist Party leader, Zhang guided the country's rise to economic power. He welcomed capitalists into the party and brought in foreign investment after China joined the WTO. China eventually became the second largest economy after the United States. Zhang enjoyed a friendly public image. However, he severely punished political opposition. His most famous target was Falun Gong, a spiritual group founded in the early 1990s. Chinese leaders feared its popularity. Falun Gong had tens of thousands of followers, including military officers. Activists tried to form an opposition China Democracy Party, a move permitted by Chinese law, but they were found guilty of subversion and sentenced to prison. Zhang supervised the return of Hong Kong to China on July 1, 1997. It had been ruled by the British for over 150 years. The nearby Portuguese territory of Macau was returned to China in 1999. Hong Kong was promised self-rule and became a center for mainland Chinese companies with business overseas. Meanwhile, Zhang took a hard position on China's ownership of Taiwan. China considers the island a rebel province. During Taiwan's first direct presidential election in 1996, Zhang's government tried to frighten voters by firing missiles into waters near its coast. At the same time, trade between the mainland and Taiwan grew to billions of dollars a year. I'm Dan Novak.
Twitter says it is no longer enforcing a policy that aimed to limit misinformation about COVID-19. The move is the latest major change at Twitter since American businessman Elon Musk took ownership of the social media service in October. A short statement announcing the change was added to an official Twitter page that explained the company's efforts to provide factual information about COVID-19. Effective November 23, 2022, Twitter is no longer enforcing the COVID-19 misleading information policy, the statement said. The statement did not provide additional details on exact enforcement measures that would change. During the pandemic, Twitter established several measures aimed at helping users learn more about COVID-19. It also launched efforts to prevent misleading information from appearing on the service. The efforts included banning some users who repeatedly published material on COVID-19 identified as misinformation. Other social media services established similar measures. They included Facebook parent Meta and Alphabet-owned YouTube. Twitter's announced policy change was praised by some people and criticized by others. Some public health officials warned the change could bring more false claims about COVID-19. They said it could lead to increased material claiming vaccines to fight the virus are ineffective or unsafe. Bad news, tweeted public health scientist Eric Feigl-Ding about the latest change at Twitter under Musk. However, Feigl-Ding urged people not to flee Twitter. Stay, folks, do not cede the town square to them, he tweeted. Musk has described himself as a free speech absolutist who is seeking to make Twitter available to people with widely different opinions. He has described earlier Twitter rules that sought to limit misinformation and hate speech as forms of censorship. Soon after the new announcement, some Twitter users tested the new lack of enforcement and celebrated the service's latest hands-off rule. Simone Gold is a doctor who created and leads the organization America's Frontline Doctors. Gold and her group have criticized Twitter and other social media companies. Gold tweeted, "This policy was used to silence people across the world who questioned the media narrative surrounding the virus and treatment options. She declared Twitter's latest announcement a win for free speech and medical freedom. Paul Russo is a social media researcher and administrator at the Katz School of Science and Health at Yeshiva University in New York. He told the Associated Press that Twitter's past efforts to stop false claims about COVID-19 were not perfect. However, he said the company's decision to end enforcement of its current misinformation policy represents a disservice to Twitter users. It is 100% the responsibility of the platform to protect its users from harmful content, Russo said. Russo added that the decision is the latest in a series of moves that will likely lead more users and advertisers to leave Twitter. Several big businesses have stopped advertising on Twitter over questions about its direction under Musk. Yoel Roth is the former head of trust and safety at Twitter, who left after Musk took over. When asked about Twitter's latest move, Roth said he was concerned about how many employees were left to moderate published material. Musk reportedly dismissed half of Twitter's employees shortly after taking over. Roth said it is difficult to know how many moderators are currently working at Twitter to identify and remove material that violates company policies. I couldn't tell you, he said when asked to offer an estimate. Roth added that part of the problem was that a company-wide listing of employees was turned off immediately after Musk's takeover. It was that chaotic, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn is here again today to talk a bit more about the technology report you just heard. Welcome back, Brian.
Hello, Ashley. Glad to be here.
In today's report, we learned Twitter is no longer enforcing a policy aimed at limiting misinformation about COVID-19. In the story, you bring up the issue of content moderation. Moderation is a term that seems to come up a lot in stories about social media companies. Could you explain how moderation is used here and also look at some other uses of the word?
Sure, Ashley. The definition we use in this story for moderation is a process that makes sure the rules of an internet discussion are not broken. Since social media companies have restrictions on certain kinds of content, they would use this process to make sure that no rules are being violated. And often when violations are found, content moderators, a noun form of the word, immediately remove banned material.
And it can also be a verb to moderate something, correct?
Exactly right, Ashley. When the moderators are doing their jobs, they are moderating content. And it is interesting, too, that moderate can also be used as an adjective with a completely different meaning. And for this usage, it is pronounced moderate. And in this case, the word is used to describe things that are average in size or amount.
Thanks again, Brian, for joining me and for sharing some thoughts on word usage with our listeners.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Early in 1857, the United States Supreme Court announced one of its most important rulings. The High Court decided the case of a slave named Dred Scott. Harry Monroe and Leo Scully tell us about the ruling and the continuing national debate over slavery.
Dred Scott lived in Missouri, where slavery was legal. Then he was sold to a man who took him to Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was not legal. After 4 years, he was returned to Missouri. Dred Scott demanded his freedom because of the years he had spent in places where slavery was illegal. Congress had banned slavery in those places under the Missouri Compromise Act of 1820. The Supreme Court ruled that Congress did not have the power to close territories to slavery. It said the Missouri Compromise was a violation of the United States Constitution, and that Dred Scott was not a free man.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president at the time of the Dred Scott case. Buchanan believed the Supreme Court's decision would put an end to the dispute over slavery. He believed that Americans, North and South, would accept the decision as the final word in the dispute. This did not happen. The Dred Scott decision did not calm the storm that divided the nation. Instead, it increased its fury.
New trouble threatened to break out in the territory of Kansas between pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers. In the past few years, the two sides had argued and fought over their opinions. They even had formed two separate governments. The pro-slavery forces controlled the legal government. The anti-slavery forces controlled an opposition government which had no power. Supporters of slavery wanted to organize a constitutional convention that could put Kansas into the Union as a slave state. The pro-slavery legislature passed a bill calling for such a convention. The bill gave supporters of slavery every chance to control the election of delegates to the convention. And it gave the convention complete freedom to make its own rules. The bill provided no way for the people of Kansas to vote on their own constitution.
The governor of the Kansas Territory, John Geary, vetoed the bill. But the legislature quickly overruled his veto. Pro-slavery men called for Geary to get out of Kansas. Some talked of shooting him if he did not leave. Governor Geary had been living under extreme tension for months. He had worked hard to keep Kansas peaceful. He was angry because he could get no help from the federal government. He sent his resignation to President Buchanan. Then the former governor spoke publicly. He said most of the settlers in Kansas were peace-loving people. He said only a small group was responsible for the trouble there. Geary said a few powerful men hoped to make Kansas a slave state. If this failed, Geary said, they hoped their actions would produce civil war.
President Buchanan appointed a new governor for Kansas. Buchanan told him that slavery in the territory must be decided on the votes of the people of the territory. And he said the people must be given a fair chance to approve or reject a constitution for statehood. The new governor arrived in Kansas at the end of May 1857. He explained his policies in a speech to the people of Kansas. The new governor promised to enforce the laws of the pro-slavery legislature, but only those laws which were constitutional. He urged everyone to vote in the coming election of delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He said he was hopeful that the convention would offer its constitution to the people for their approval or rejection. He added that Congress would not accept Kansas as a slave state or a free state until the people had voted on the question of slavery.
On June 15th, the election was held for delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Most anti-slavery men did not vote because their names had been kept off the voting lists by pro-slavery officials. Others refused to vote because they believed the election was unfair. 60 delegates were elected. All supported slavery. They planned to meet in the autumn to begin work on a constitution for Kansas. Most of the delegates were wild, rough men who found it difficult to read and write. But these men were sure of one thing. They wanted Kansas to be a slave state.
The delegates began the Constitution by claiming that the right of property was higher than any constitutional power. They said a slave owner had as much right to his property as the owner of any other kind of property. Then they wrote the different parts of the document. One part of the Constitution severely limited the right of the legislature to free slaves. Another part barred free Negroes from entering Kansas. And another prevented the Constitution from being changed for 7 years.
Most of the delegates to the Kansas Constitutional Convention wanted to send the document directly to Congress for approval. They did not want to give the people of Kansas a chance to vote on it. They were sure that the majority of the population would reject a constitution that made slavery legal. Some delegates, however, knew that Congress would not approve statehood for Kansas unless the people voted on the Constitution. The two sides finally agreed on a compromise.
The Constitution itself would not be offered to the people. Instead, the people would vote only on the question of slavery. They could vote for the Constitution with slavery, or the Constitution without slavery. If the voters approved the Constitution with slavery, then Kansas would be open to new slaves. If they approved the Constitution without slavery, then Kansas would be closed to new slaves. Slaves already in the territory could be kept there. This compromise brought a cry of anger from opponents of slavery in Kansas. They said the Constitutional Convention had only given them the right to vote for limited slavery or unlimited slavery. It had not given them the right to vote for freedom.
President Buchanan had promised the people of Kansas that they would have a fair chance to vote on their constitution. But members of his cabinet told him to forget this promise. They said Americans were tired of the dispute in Kansas and would accept any settlement. They told Buchanan that approval of the Constitution would end the Kansas problem. It would satisfy the South, they said, and the North would soon forget about Kansas. Under this pressure, President Buchanan made his decision. He would ask Congress to accept the pro-slavery Kansas Constitution and make the territory a slave state.
In Kansas, the vote on slavery was held. Most opponents of slavery did not vote. They were waiting until they could vote against the complete statehood constitution. Many of the votes were illegal. Still, Kansas officials declared that slavery had been approved. They urged Congress to make Kansas a state under this condition. Shortly after, President Buchanan sent Congress a similar message. Buchanan's chief opponent on the statehood bill was a member of his own Democratic Party, Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. Douglas did not oppose slavery, but he believed that the people of a territory had the right to make their own decision to accept or reject slavery.
Stephen Douglas united other Democrats and members of the anti-slavery Republican Party to fight against the bill in the Senate. He lost. The Senate approved the bill to make Kansas a state where slavery was legal. The House of Representatives, however, rejected the bill. Instead, it approved a bill to let the people of Kansas vote again on their statehood constitution. The Senate approved a compromise version of this House bill.
So the people of Kansas got another chance to show that they did not want a pro-slavery constitution. They voted and rejected the constitution by a large majority. The pro-slavery statehood constitution was dead. Kansas would continue as a territory for a few more years, but there would be no further attempt to make it a slave state.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.